pulled to strings and tatters. It fled yipping with agony, shaking its head crazily from side to side, spraying droplets of blood to the left and right. And in the crude telepathy that all animals of like kind share, Kojak could read its over-and-over thought clearly enough. "Wasps in me! Oh, the wasps! The wasps in my head! Wasps are up my head! Oh!" And then the others hit him, one from the left and another from the right, like huge blunt bullets. The last of the trio submarining in low, grinning, snapping, ready to pull out his intestines. Kojak had broken to the right, baying hoarsely, wanting to deal with that one first so he could get under the porch. If he could get under the porch, he could stand them off, maybe forever. Lying on the porch now, he relived the battle in a kind of slow motion. The growls and howls, the strikes and withdrawals, the smell of blood that had gotten into his brain and gradually turned him into a kind of fighting machine, unaware of his own wounds until later. He sent the wolf that had been on his right the way of the first one of its eyes dead and a huge, gouting and probably mortal wound in the side of its throat. But the wolf had done its own damage in return. Most of it was superficial, but two of the gores were extremely deep, wounds that would heal to hard and twisting scar tissue, like a scrawling lowercase T. Even when he was an old, old dog, and Kojak lived another 16 years, long after Glenn Bateman died, those scars would pain and throb on wet days. He had fought free, had scrambled under the porch, and when one of the two remaining wolves, overcome with bloodlust, tried to wriggle in after him, Kojak sprang on it, pinned it, and ripped its throat out. The other retreated almost to the edge of the corn, whining uneasily. If Kojak had come out to do battle, it would have fled with its tail between its legs. But Kojak didn't come out, not then. He was done in. He could only lie on his side, panting rapidly and weakly, licking his wounds and growling deep in his chest whenever he saw the shadow of the remaining wolf draw near. Then it was dark, and a misty half-moon rode the sky over Nebraska. And each time the last wolf heard Kojak alive and presumably still ready to fight, it shied away, whining. Sometime after midnight it left, leaving Kojak alone to see if he would live or die. In the early morning hours he had felt the presence of some other animal, something that terrified him into a series of soft whimpers. It was a thing in the corn, a thing walking in the corn, hunting for him, perhaps. Kojak lay shivering, waiting to see if this thing would find him, this horrible thing that felt like a man and a wolf and an eye, some dark thing like an ancient crocodile in the corn. Some unknown time later, after the moon went down, Kojak felt that it was gone. He fell asleep. He had lain up under the porch for 3 days, coming out only when hunger and thirst drove him out. There was always a puddle of water gathered below the lip of the hand pump in the yard. And in the house there were all sorts of rich scraps, many of them from the meal Mother Abigail had cooked for Nick's party. When Kojak felt he could go on, he knew where to go. It was not a scent that told him. It was a deep sense of heat that had come out of his own deep and mortal time, a glowing pocket of heat to the west of him. And so he came, limping most of the last 500 miles on 3 legs, the pain always gnawing at his belly. From time to time he was able to smell the man, and thus knew he was on the right track. And at last he was here. The man was here. There were no wolves here. Food was here. There was no sense of that dark thing. The man with the stink of a wolf and the feel of an eye that could see you over long miles if it happened to turn your way. For now, things were fine. And so thinking, so far as dogs can think in their careful relating to a world seen almost wholly through feelings, Kojak drifted down deeper, now into real sleep, now into a dream, a good dream of chasing rabbits through the clover and timothy grass that was belly high and wet with soothing dew. His name was Big Steve. This was the North 40. And oh, the rabbits are everywhere this gray and endless morning. As he dreamed, his paws twitched. Chapter 53. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 17, 1990. This meeting was held at the home of Larry Underwood on South 42nd Street in the Table Mesa area. All members of the committee were present. The first item of business concerned having the ad hoc committee elected as the permanent Boulder committee. Fran Goldsmith was recognized. Fran. Both Stu and I agreed that the best, easiest way for us all to get elected would be if Mother Abigail endorsed the whole slate. It would save us the problem of having 20 people nominated by their friends and possibly upsetting the apple cart. But now we'll have to do it another way. I'm not going to suggest anything that isn't perfectly democratic, and you all know the plan anyway, but I just want to reemphasize that each of us has to make sure we have someone who will nominate and second us. We won't do it for each other, obviously. That would look too much like the mafia. And if you can't find one person to nominate you and another to second you, you might as well give up anyway. Sue. Wow, that's sneaky, Fran. Fran. Yes, it is, a little. Glenn. We're edging back into the subject of the committee's morality, and although I'm sure we all find that an endlessly fascinating topic, I'd like to see it tabled for the next few months. I think we just have to agree that we're serving in the Free Zone's best interest and leave it at that. Ralph. You sound a little pissed, Glenn. Glenn. I am a little pissed, I admit it. The very fact that we've spent so much time eating at our own livers on this subject should give a pretty good indication as to where our hearts are. Sue. The road to hell is paved with, Glenn, good intentions, yes, and since we all seem so worried about our intentions, we must surely be on the highway to heaven. Glenn then said that he had intended to address the committee on the subject of our scouts or spies or whatever you want to call them, but that he wanted to make a motion instead that we meet to discuss that on the 19th. Stu asked him why. Glenn. Because we might not all be here on the 19th. Somebody might get voted out. It's a remote possibility, but no one really knows what a large group of people is going to do when they all get together in one place. We ought to be as careful as we can. That was good for a moment of silence, and the committee voted 7-0 to meet on the 19th, as a permanent committee, to discuss the question of the scouts, or spies, or whatever. Stu was recognized to put a third item of business before the committee concerning Mother Abigail. Stu. As you know, she's gone off for reasons of her own. Her note says she'll be gone for a while, which is pretty vague, and that she'll be back if it's God's will. Now, that's not very encouraging. We've had a search party out for 3 days now, and we haven't found a thing. We don't want to just drag her back, not if she doesn't want to come, but if she's lying up somewhere with a busted leg or if she's unconscious, that's a lot different. Now, part of the problem is that there just aren't enough of us to search all the wildlands around here. But another part of it is the same thing that's slowing us down at the power station. There's just no organization. So what I'm looking for is permission to put this search party on the agenda of the big meeting tomorrow night, same as the power station and the burial crew. And I'd like to see Harold Lauder in charge, because it was his idea in the first place. Glenn said that he didn't think any search party was going to find very good news after a week or so. After all, the lady in question is 108 years old. The committee as a whole agreed with that and then voted in favor of the motion, 7-0, as Stu had put it. To make this record as honest as possible, I should add there were several expressions of doubt over putting Harold in charge. But as Stu pointed out, it had been his idea to begin with, and not to give him command of the search party would be a direct slap in the face. Nick. I withdraw my objection to Harold, but not my basic reservations. I just don't like him very much. Ralph Brentner asked if either Stu or Glenn would write out Stu's motion about the search party so he could add it to the agenda, which he plans to print at the high school tonight. Stu said he'd be glad to. Larry Underwood then moved that we adjourn. Ralph seconded it, and it was voted 7-0. Francis Goldsmith, Secretary. The turnout for the meeting the next evening was almost total, and for the first time Larry Underwood, who had been in the zone only a week, got an idea of just how large the community was becoming. It was one thing to see people coming and going on the streets, usually alone or by twos, and quite another thing to see them all gathered together in one place, Chautauqua Auditorium. The place was full, every seat taken, and more people sitting in the aisles and standing at the back of the hall. They were a curiously subdued crowd, murmuring but not babbling. For the first time since he had gotten to Boulder, it had rained all day long, a soft drizzle that seemed to hang suspended in the air, fogging you rather than wetting you. And even with the assemblage of close to 600, you could hear the quiet sound of rain on the roof. The loudest sound inside was the constant riffle of paper as people looked at the mimeographed agendas that had been piled up on two card tables just inside the double doors. This agenda read, "The Boulder Free Zone. Open Meeting Agenda, August 18, 1990. 1. To see if the Free Zone will agree to read and ratify the Constitution of the United States of America. 2. To see if the Free Zone will agree to read and ratify the Bill of Rights to the Constitution of the United States of America. 3. To see if the Free Zone will nominate and elect a slate of 7 Free Zone representatives to serve as a governing board. 4. To see if the Free Zone will agree to veto power for Abigail Freemantle on any and all matters agreed to by the Free Zone representatives. 5. To see if the Free Zone will approve a burial committee of at least 20 persons initially to decently inter those who died of the superflu epidemic in Boulder. 6. To see if the Free Zone will approve a power committee of at least 60 persons initially to get the electricity back on before cold weather. 7. To see if the Free Zone will approve a search committee of at least 15 persons, its purpose to find the whereabouts of Abigail Freemantle, if possible." Larry found that his nervous hands had been busy folding this agenda, which he knew nearly word for word, into a paper airplane. Being on the ad hoc committee was sort of fun, like a game, children playing at parliamentary process in someone's living room, sitting around and drinking Cokes, having a piece of the cake Franny had made, talking things over. Even the part about sending spies over the mountains and right into the dark man's lap had seemed like a game, partly because it was a thing he couldn't imagine doing himself. You'd have to have lost most of your marbles to face such a living nightmare. But in their closed sessions, with the room comfortably lit with Coleman gas lanterns, it had seemed okay. And if the judge or Dana Jurgens or Tom Cullen got caught, it seemed, in those closed sessions at least, a thing no more important than losing a rook or a queen in a chess game. But now, sitting halfway down the hall, with Lucy on one side and Leo on the other, he had not seen Nadine all day, and Leo didn't seem to know where she was either. "Out," had been his disinterested response. The truth of it came home, and in his guts it felt as if a battering ram was in use. It was no game. There were 580 people here, and most of them didn't have any idea that Larry Underwood wasn't no nice guy, or that the first person Larry Underwood had attempted to take care of after the epidemic had died of a drug overdose. His hands were damp and chilly. They were trying to fold the agenda into a paper plane again, and he stopped them. Lucy took one of them, squeezed it, and smiled at him. He was able to respond only with something that felt like a grimace, and in his heart he heard his mother's voice. "There's something left out of you, Larry." Thinking of that made him feel panicky. Was there a way out of this, or had things already gone too far? He didn't want this millstone. He had already made a motion in closed session that could send Judge Ferris to his death. If he was voted out and someone else was voted into his seat, they'd have to take another vote on sending the judge, wouldn't they? Sure they would, and they'd vote to send someone else. "When Lori Constable nominates me, I'll just stand up and say I decline. Sure, nobody can force me, can they? Not if I decide I want out. And who the fuck needs this kind of hassle?" Wayne Stuckey on that long-ago beach, saying, "There's something in you that's like biting on tinfoil." Quietly, Lucy said, "You'll be fine." He jumped. "Huh? I said you'll be fine. Won't he, Leo?" "Oh, yes," Leo said, bobbing his head. His eyes never left the audience, as if they had not yet been able to communicate its size to his brain. "Fine." "You don't understand, you numb broad," Larry thought. "You're holding my hand, and you don't understand that I could make a bad decision and wind up killing both of you. I'm well on my way to killing Judge Ferris, and he's seconding my fucking nomination. What a Polish fire drill this turned out to be." A little sound escaped his throat. "Did you say something?" Lucy asked. No. Then Stu was walking across the stage to the podium, his red sweater and blue jeans very bright and clear in the harsh glow of the emergency lights, which were running from a Honda generator that Brad Kitchener and part of his crew from the power station had set up. The applause started somewhere in the middle of the hall. Larry was never sure where, and a cynical part of him was always convinced that it had been a plot arranged by Glenn Bateman, their resident expert in the art-craft of crowd management. At any rate, it didn't really matter. The first solitary spats swelled to a thunder of applause. On the stage, Stu paused by the podium, looking comically amazed. The applause was joined by cheers and shrill whistles. Then the entire audience rose to its feet, the applause swelling to a sound like heavy rain, and people were shouting, "Bravo! Bravo!" Stu held up his hands, but they wouldn't stop. If anything, the sound redoubled in intensity. Larry glanced sideways at Lucy and saw she was applauding strenuously, her eyes fixed on Stu, her mouth curved in a trembling but triumphant smile. She was crying. On his other side, Leo was also applauding, bringing his hands together again and again with so much force that Larry thought they would fall off if Leo kept on much longer. In the extremity of his joy, Leo's carefully won-back vocabulary had deserted him, the way English will sometimes desert a man or woman who has learned it as his or her second tongue. He could only hoot loudly and enthusiastically. Brad and Ralph had also run a PA from the generator, and now Stu blew into the mic, and then spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen," but the applause rolled on. "Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll take your seats," but they were not ready to take their seats. The applause roared on, and Larry looked down because his own hands hurt, and he saw that he was applauding as frantically as the rest. "Ladies and gentlemen," the applause thundered and echoed. Overhead, a family of barn swallows that had taken up residence in this fine and private place after the plague struck, now flew about crazily, swooping and diving, mad to get away to some place where people weren't. "We're applauding ourselves," Larry thought. "We're applauding the fact that we're here, alive, together. Maybe we're saying hello to the group self again, I don't know. Hello, Boulder. Finally. Good to be here. Great to be alive. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd take your seats, please, I sure would appreciate it." The applause began to taper off little by little. Now you could hear ladies, and some men, too, sniffing. Noses were honked. Conversations were whispered. There was that rustling auditorium sound of people taking their seats. "I'm glad you're all here," Stu said. "I'm glad to be here myself." There was a whine of feedback from the PA, and Stu muttered, "Goddamn thing," which was clearly picked up and broadcast. There was a ripple of laughter, and Stu colored. "Guess we're all going to have to get used to this stuff again," he said, and that set off another burst of applause. When that had run itself out, Stu said, "For those of you who don't know me, I'm Stuart Redman, originally from Arnett, Texas. Although that seems a far way down the road from where I am now, let me tell you." He cleared his throat, feedback whined briefly, and he took a wary step back from the mic. "I'm also pretty nervous up here, so bear with me." "We will, Stu," Harry Dunbarton yelled exuberantly, and there was appreciative laughter. It's like a camp meeting, Larry thought. Next they'll be singing hymns. If Mother Abigail was here, I bet we would be all ready. "Last time I had so many people looking at me was when our little consolidated high school made it to the football playoffs. And then they had 21 other guys to look at, too, not to mention some girls in those little tiny skirts." A hearty burst of laughter. Lucy pulled at Larry's neck and whispered in his ear, "What was he worried about? He's a natural." Larry nodded. "But if you'll bear with me, I'll get through it somehow," Stu said. More applause. This crowd would applaud Nixon's resignation speech and ask him to encore on the piano, Larry thought. "First off, I should explain about the ad hoc committee and how I happened to be up here at all," Stu said. "There are 7 of us who got together and planned for this meeting so we could get organized somehow. There's a lot of things to do, and I'd like to introduce each member of our committee to you now, and I hope you saved some applause for them because they all pitched together to work out the agenda you got in your hands right now. First, Miss Frances Goldsmith. Stand up, Franny, and let him see what you look like with a dress on." Fran stood up. She was wearing a pretty Kelly green dress and a modest string of pearls that might have cost $2,000 in the old days. She was roundly applauded, the applause accompanied by some good-natured wolf whistles. Fran sat down, blushing furiously, and before the applause could die away entirely, Stu went on. "Mr. Glenn Bateman from Woodsville, New Hampshire." Glenn stood, and they applauded him. He flipped a pair of twin V's from each of his closed fists, and the crowd roared its approval. Stu introduced Larry second to last, and he stood up, aware that Lucy was smiling up at him, and then that was lost in a warm comber of applause that washed over him. Once, he thought, in another world there would have been concerts, and this kind of applause would have been reserved for the show closer, a little nothing tune called "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?" This was better. He only stood for a second, but it seemed much longer. He knew he would not decline his nomination. Stu introduced Nick last, and he got the longest, loudest applause. When it died away, Stu said, "This wasn't on the agenda, but I wonder if we could start by singing the national anthem. I guess you folks remember the words and the tune." There was that ruffling, shuffling sound of people getting to their feet. Another pause as everyone waited for someone else to start. Then a girl's sweet voice rose in the air, solo for only the first three syllables. "Oh, say can." It was Franny's voice, but for a moment it seemed to Larry to be underlaid by another voice, his own. And the place was not Boulder, but upstate Vermont, and the day was July 4th. The Republic was 214 years old, and Rita lay dead in the tent behind him, her mouth filled with green puke and a bottle of pills in her stiffening hand. A chill of goose flesh passed over him, and suddenly he felt that they were being watched, watched by something that could, in the words of that old song by The Who, see for miles and miles and miles. Something awful and dark and alien. For just a moment he felt an urge to run from this place. Just run and never stop. This was no game they were playing here. This was serious business. Killing business. Maybe worse. Then other voices joined in. "Can you see by the dawn's early light?" And Lucy was singing, holding his hand, crying again. And others were crying. Most of them were crying. Crying for what was lost and bitter, the runaway American dream, chrome-wheeled, fuel-injected, and stepping out over the line. And suddenly his memory was not of Rita, dead in the tent, but of he and his mother at Yankee Stadium. It was September 29th. The Yankees were only a game and a half behind the Red Sox, and all things were still possible. There were 55,000 people in the stadium, all standing. The players in the field with their caps over their hearts, Guidry on the mound, Ricky Henderson was standing in deep left field. "By the twilight's last gleaming." And the light standards were on in the purple gloaming, moths and night flyers banging softly against them, and New York was around them, teeming, city of night and light. Larry joined the singing, too. And when it was done and the applause rolled out once more, he was crying a bit himself. Rita was gone. Alice Underwood was gone. New York was gone. America was gone. Even if they could defeat Randall Flagg, whatever they might make would never be the same as that world of dark streets and bright dreams. Sweating freely under the bright emergency lights, Stu called the first items. Reading and ratification of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The singing of the anthem had also affected him deeply, and he wasn't alone. Half the audience, more, was in tears. No one asked for an actual reading of either document, which would have been their right under the parliamentary process, for which Stu was profoundly grateful. He wasn't much of a reader. The reading section of each item was approved by the Free Zone citizens. Glenn Bateman rose and moved that they accept both documents as governing Free Zone law. A voice in the back said, "Second that." "Moved and seconded," Stu said. Those in favor say aye. Aye to the rooftops. Kojak, who had been sleeping by Glenn's chair, looked up, blinked, and then laid his muzzle on his paws again. A moment later he looked up again as the crowd gave themselves a thunderous round of applause. They like voting, Stu thought. It makes them feel like they're finally in control of something again. God knows they need that feeling. We all need it. That preliminary taken care of, Stu felt tension worm into his muscles. Now, he thought, we'll see if there are any nasty surprises waiting for us. The third item on your agenda reads, he began, and then he had to clear his throat again. Feedback whined at him, making him sweat even more. Fran was looking calmly up at him, nodding for him to go on. It reads, to see if the Free Zone will nominate and elect a slate of 7 Free Zone representatives. That means, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman? Stu looked up from his jotted notes and felt a real jolt of fear, accompanied by something like a premonition. It was Harold Lauder. Harold was dressed in a suit and a tie, his hair was neatly combed, and he was standing halfway up the middle aisle. Once Glenn had said he thought the opposition might coalesce around Harold. But so soon? He hoped not. For just a moment he thought wildly of not recognizing Harold, but both Nick and Glenn had warned him of the dangers inherent in making any part of this look like a railroad job. He wondered if he had been wrong about Harold turning over a new leaf. It looked as if he was going to find out right here. Chair recognizes Harold Lauder. Heads turned, necks craned to see Harold better. I'd like to move that we accept the slate of ad hoc committee members in toto as the permanent committee. If they'll serve, that is. Harold sat down. There was a moment of silence. Stu thought crazily, Toto? Toto? Wasn't that a dog in The Wizard of Oz? Then the applause swelled out again, filling the room, and dozens of cries of, I second, rang out. Harold was sitting placidly in his seat again, smiling and talking to the people who were thumping him on the back. Stu brought his gavel down 6 times for order. He planned this, Stu thought. These people are going to elect us, but it's Harold they'll remember. Still, he got to the root of the thing in a way none of us thought of, not even Glenn. It was pretty damn near a stroke of genius. So why should he be so upset? Was he jealous, maybe? Were his good resolutions about Harold, made only the day before yesterday, already going by the boards? There's a motion on the floor, he blared into the mic, ignoring the feedback whine this time. Motion on the floor, folks! He pounded the gavel and they quieted to a low babble. It's been moved and seconded that we accept the ad hoc committee just as it stands as the permanent Free Zone committee. Before we go to a discussion of the motion or to a vote, I ought to ask if anyone now serving on the committee has an objection or would like to step down. Silence from the floor. Very well, Stu said. Discussion of the motion? I don't think we need any, Stu, Dick Ellis said. It's a grand idea. Let's vote. Applause greeted this, and Stu needed no further urging. Charlie Impening was waving his hand to be recognized, but Stu ignored him, a good case of selective perception, Glenn Bateman would have said, and called the question. Those in favor of Harold Lauder's motion, please signify by saying aye. Aye, they bellowed, sending the barn swallows into another frenzy. Opposed? But no one was, not even Charlie Impening, at least vocally. There was not a nay in the chamber. So Stu pushed on to the next item of business, feeling slightly dazed, as if someone, namely Harold Lauder, had crept up behind him and clapped him on the head with a large sledgehammer made out of silly putty. "Let's get off and push them a while, want to?" Fran asked. She sounded tired. "Sure." He got off his bike and walked along beside her. You okay, Fran? The baby bothering?
No, I'm just tired. It's 1:15 in the morning, or hadn't you noticed?
Yeah, it's late, Stu agreed. And they pushed their bikes side by side in companionable silence. The meeting had gone on until an hour ago, most of the discussion centering on the search party for Mother Abigail. The other items had all passed with a minimum of discussion,
although Judge Ferris had provided a fascinating piece of information that explained why there were so relatively few bodies in Boulder. According to the last four issues of The Camera, Boulder's daily newspaper, a wild rumor had swept the community, a rumor that the superflu had originated in the Boulder air testing facility on Broadway. Spokesmen for the center, the few still on their feet, protested that it was utter nonsense, and anyone who doubted it was free to tour the facility, where they would find nothing more dangerous than air pollution indicators and wind vectoring devices. In spite of this, the rumor persisted, probably fed by the hysterical temper of those terrible days in late June. The air testing center had been either bombed or burned, and much of Boulder's population had fled. Both the burial committee and the power committee had been passed with an amendment from Harold Lauder, who had seemed almost awesomely prepared for the meeting, to the effect that each committee be increased by 2 for each increase of 100 in the total free zone population. The search committee was also voted with no opposition, but the discussion of Mother Abigail's disappearance had been a protracted one. Glenn had advised Stu before the meeting not to limit discussion on this topic unless absolutely necessary. It was worrying all of them, especially the idea that their spiritual leader believed she had committed some sort of sin. Best to let them get it off their chests. On the back of her note, the old woman had scrawled 2 biblical references, Proverbs chapter 11 verses 1 to 3 and Proverbs chapter 21 verses 28 to 31. Judge Ferris had searched these out with the careful diligence of a lawyer preparing a brief, and at the beginning of the discussion, he rose and read them in his cracked and apocalyptic old man's voice. The verses in the 11th chapter of Proverbs stated, "A false balance is an abomination of the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. When pride cometh, then cometh shame, but with the lowly is wisdom. The integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of transgressors shall destroy them." The quotation from the 21st chapter was in a similar vein. "A false witness shall perish, but the man that heareth speaketh constantly. A wicked man hardeneth his face, but as for the upright, he directeth his way. There is no wisdom, nor understanding, nor counsel against the Lord. The horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord." The talk following the judge's oration, it could be called nothing else, of these 2 scriptural tidbits, had ranged over far-reaching and often comical ground. One man stated ominously that if the chapter numbers were added, you came out with 31, the number of chapters in the book of Revelations. Judge Ferris rose again to say that the book of Revelations had only 22 chapters, at least in his Bible, and that in any case, 21 and 11 added up to 32, not 31. The aspiring numerologist muttered but said no more. Another fellow stated that he had seen lights in the sky the night before Mother Abigail's disappearance, and that the prophet Isaiah had confirmed the existence of flying saucers. So they'd better put that in their collective pipe and smoke it, hadn't they? Judge Ferris rose once more, this time to point out that the previous gentleman had mistaken Isaiah for Ezekiel, that the exact reference was not to flying saucers but to a wheel within a wheel, and that the judge himself was of the opinion that the only flying saucers yet proven were those that sometimes flew during marital spats. Much of the other discussion was a rehash of the dreams, which had ceased altogether, as far as anyone knew, and now seemed rather dreamlike themselves. Person after person rose to protest the charge that Mother Abigail had laid upon herself, that of pride. They spoke of her courtesy and her ability to put a person at ease with just a word or a sentence. Ralph Brentner, who looked awed by the size of the crowd and was nearly tongue-tied, but determined to speak his piece, rose and spoke in that vein for nearly 5 minutes, adding at the end that he had not known a finer woman since his mother had died. When he sat down, he seemed very near tears. When taken together, the discussion reminded Stu uncomfortably of a wake. It told him that in their hearts they had already come halfway to giving her up. If she did return now, Abby Freemantle would find herself welcomed, still sought after, still listened to, but she would also find, Stu thought, that her position was subtly changed. If a showdown between her and the Free Zone Committee came, it was no longer a foregone conclusion that she would win, veto power or not. She had gone away, and the committee had continued to exist. The community would not forget that, as they had already half forgotten the power the dreams had once briefly held over their lives. After the meeting, more than 2 dozen people had sat for a while on the lawn behind Chautauqua Hall. The rain had stopped, the clouds were tattering, and the evening was pleasantly cool. Stu and Franny had sat with Larry, Lucy, Leo, and Harold. "You darn near knocked us out of the ballpark this evening," Larry told Harold. He nudged Franny with an elbow. "I told you he was A-side, didn't I?" Harold had merely smiled and shrugged modestly. "A couple of ideas, that's all. You seven have started things moving again. You should at least have the privilege of seeing it through to the end of the beginning." Now 15 minutes after the two of them had left that impromptu gathering, and still 10 minutes from home, Stu repeated, "You sure you're feeling okay?" "Yes, my legs are a little tired, that's all."
"You want to take it easy, Francis."
"Don't call me that. You know I hate it."
"I'm sorry. I won't do it again, Francis."
"All men are bastards."
"I'm going to try and improve my act, Francis. Honest I am."
She showed him her tongue, which came to an interesting point, but he could tell her heart wasn't in the banter, and he dropped it. She looked pale and rather listless, a startling contrast to the Franny who had sung the national anthem with such heart a few hours earlier. "Something giving you the blues, honey?" She shook her head no, but he thought he saw tears in her eyes.
"What is it? Tell me."
"It's nothing. That's what's the matter. Nothing is what's bothering me. It's over, and I finally realized it, that's all. Less than 600 people singing the Star-Spangled Banner. It just kind of hit me all at once. No hot dog stands. The Ferris wheel isn't going around and around at Coney Island tonight. No one's having a nightcap at the Space Needle in Seattle. Someone finally found a way to clean up the dope in Boston's combat zone and the chicken ranch business in Times Square. Those were terrible things, but I think the cure was a lot worse than the disease. Know what I mean?"
"Yeah, I do."
"In my diary, I had a little section called Things to Remember, so the baby would know, oh, all the things he never will. And it gives me the blues thinking of that. I should have called it Things That Are Gone." She did sob a little, stopping her bike so she could put the back of her hand to her mouth and try to keep it in.
"It got everybody the same way," Stu said, putting an arm around her. "A lot of people are going to cry themselves to sleep tonight. You better believe it."
"I don't see how you can grieve for a whole country," she said, crying harder. "But I guess you can. These little things keep shooting through my mind. Car salesman, Frank Sinatra. Old Orchard Beach in July, all crowded with people, most of them from Quebec. That stupid guy on MTV, Randy, I think his name was. The Times, oh, God, I sound like a friggin' Rod McEwen poem."
He held her, patting her back, remembering one time when his Aunt Betty had gotten a little crying fit over some bread that didn't rise. She was big with his little cousin Laddie then, 7 months or so.
And Stu could remember her wiping her eyes with the corner of a dish towel and telling him to never mind. Any pregnant woman was just 2 doors down from the mental ward because the juices their glands put out were always scrambled up into a stew. After a while, Franny said, "Okay, okay, better. Let's go."
"Franny, I love you," he said. They resumed pushing their bikes.
She asked him, "What do you remember best? What's the one thing?"
"Well, you know," he said, and then stopped with a little laugh.
"No, I don't know, Stuart."
"It's crazy.
Tell me."
"I don't know if I want to. You'll start looking for the guys with the butterfly nets."
"Tell me."
She had seen Stu in many moods, but this curious, embarrassed uneasiness was new to her.
"I never told anybody," he said, "but I have been thinking on it the last couple of weeks. Something happened to me back in 1982. I was pumping gas at Bill Hapscom's gas station then. He used to hire me on if he could when I was laid off at the calculator plant in town.
He had me on part-time, 11 p.m. to closin', which was 3 in the morning back in those days. There wasn't much business after the people getting off the 3 to 11 shift at the Dixie Paper Factory stopped to get their gas. Lots of nights there wasn't a single car stop between 12 and 3. I'd sit there and read a book or a magazine, and lots of nights I'd doze off, you know?
Yes.
She did know. In her mind's eye, she could see him, the man who would become her man in the fullness of time and the peculiarity of events. A broad-shouldered man sleeping in a plastic wool-coat chair with a book open and face down on his lap. She saw him sleeping in an island of white light, an island surrounded by a great inland sea of Texas night. She loved him in this picture, as she loved him in all the pictures her mind drew. Well, this one night, it was about 2:15, and I was sitting behind Hap's desk with my feet up, reading some Western, Louis L'Amour, Elmore Leonard, someone like that. And in pulls this big old Pontiac with all the windows rolled down and the tape player going like mad, playing Hank Williams. I even remember the song. It was Movin' On. This guy, not young and not old, is all by himself. He was a good-looking man, but in a way that was a little scary. I mean, he looked like he might do scary things without thinking very hard about him. He had bushy, curly, dark hair. There was a bottle of wine snugged down between his legs and a pair of styrofoam dice hanging from the rearview mirror. He says, "Hi, Test." And I said, "Okay." But for a minute I just stood there and looked at him. Because he looked familiar. I was playing Place the Face. They were on the corner now. Their apartment building was across the street. They paused there. Franny was looking at him closely. So I said, "Don't I know you? Ain't you from up around Corbett or Maxon?" But it didn't really seem like I knew him from those two towns. And he says, "No, but I passed through Corbett once with my family when I was just a kid. It seems like I passed through just about every place in America when I was a kid. My dad was in the Air Force." So I went back and filled up his car, and all the time I'm thinking about him, playing Place the Face, and all at once it came to me. All at once I knew, and I damn near pissed myself, because the man behind the wheel of that Pontiac was supposed to be dead. Who was he, Stuart? Who was he? No, you let me tell it my way, Franny. Not that it isn't a crazy story no matter what way you tell it. I went back to the window, and I says, "That'll be $6.30. He gave me 2 $5 bills and told me I could keep the change. And I says, "Well, I think I might have you placed now." And he says, "Well, maybe you do." And he gives me this weird, chilly smile. And all the time Hank Williams is singing about going to town. I says, "If you are who I think you are, you're supposed to be dead." He says, "You don't want to believe everything you read, man." I says, "You like Hank Williams, all right?" It was all I could think of to say, because I saw Franny, if I didn't say something, he was just going to roll up that power window and go tooling on down the road. And I wanted him to go, but I also didn't want him to go. Not yet. Not until I was sure. I didn't know then that a person is never sure about a lot of things, no matter how much he wants to be. He says, "Hank Williams is one of the best. I like roadhouse music." Then he says, "I'm going to New Orleans, going to drive all night, sleep all day tomorrow, then barrel house all night long. Is it the same, New Orleans?" And I says, "As what?" And he says, "Well, you know." And I says, "Well, it's all the South, you know, although there are considerable more trees down that way." And that makes him laugh. He says, "Maybe I'll see you again." But I didn't want to see him again, Franny, because he had the eyes of a man who's been trying to look into the dark for a long time and has maybe begun to see what is there. I think if I ever see that man flag, his eyes might look a little like that. Stu shook his head as they pushed their bikes across the road and parked them. "I've been thinking of that. I thought about getting some of his records after that, but I didn't want them. His voice, it's a good voice, but it gives me the creeps."
"Stuart, who are you talking about?"
"You remember a rock and roll group called The Doors? The man that stopped that night for gas in Arnett was Jim Morrison. I'm sure of it." Her mouth dropped open.
"But he died. He died in France. He—"
And then she stopped, Because there had been something funny about Morrison's death, hadn't there? Something secret.
Did he? Stu asked.
I wonder. Maybe he did, and the fellow I saw was just a guy who looked like him, but...
Do you really think it was? She asked.
They were sitting on the steps of their building now, shoulders touching, like small children waiting for their mother to call them in to supper.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I do. And until this summer, I thought that would always be the strangest thing that ever happened to me. Boy, was I wrong.
And you never told anyone, she marveled. You saw Jim Morrison years after he supposedly died, and you never told anyone. Stuart Redmond, God should have given you a combination lock instead of a mouth when he sent you out into the world.
Stu smiled.
Well, the years rolled by, as they say in the books, and whenever I thought of that night, as I did from time to time, I got surer and surer it wasn't him after all. Just someone who looked a little bit like him, you know. I had my mind pretty well at rest on the subject. But in the last few weeks I've found myself puzzling over it again. And I think more and more that it was. Hell, he might even still be alive now. That'd be a real laugh, wouldn't it?
If he is, she said, he's not here.
No, Stu agreed. I wouldn't expect him to be here. I saw his eyes, you see.
She put her hand on his arm.
That's some story.
Yeah, and there's probably 20 million people in this country with one just like it. Only about Elvis Presley or Howard Hughes.
Not anymore.
No, not anymore.
Harold was something tonight, wasn't he?
I believe that's called changing the subject.
I believe you're right.
Yes, she said, he was. He smiled at her worried tone and the slight frown which had puckered her brow.
Bothered you a little, didn't it?
Yes, but I won't say so. You're in Harold's corner now.
Now that's not fair, Fran. It bothered me, too. There we had those two advance meetings, hashed everything over to a fairly well, at least we thought so. And along comes Harold. He takes a whack-whack here and a whack-whack there and says, "Ain't that what you really meant?" And we say, "Yeah, thanks, Harold, it was."
Stu shook his head.
Putting everybody up for blanket election. How come we never thought of that, Fran? That was sharp, and we never even discussed it.
Well, none of us knew for sure what kind of mood they'd be in. I thought, especially after Mother Abigail walked off, that they'd be glum, maybe even mean, with that impening talking to them like some kind of death crow.
I wonder if he should be shut up somehow, Stu said thoughtfully.
But it wasn't like that. They were so exuberant just to be together. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I did.
It was like a tent revival, almost. I don't think it was anything Harold had planned. He just seized the moment.
I just don't know how to feel about him, Stu said. That night after we hunted for Mother Abigail, I felt real bad for him. When Ralph and Glenn turned up, he looked downright horrible, like he was going to faint or something. But when we were talking out on the lawn just now and everybody was congratulating him, he seemed puffed up like a toad. Like he was smiling on the outside, and on the inside he was saying, "There, you see what your committee's worth, you stupid bunch of fools." He's like one of those puzzles you could never figure out when you were a kid. The Chinese finger pullers, or those three steel rings that would come apart if you pulled them just the right way.
Fran stuck out her feet and looked at them. "Speaking of Harold, did you see anything funny about my feet, Stuart?"
Stu looked at them judiciously.
"Nope. Just that you're wearing those funny-looking earth shoes from up the street.
And they're almighty big, of course."
She slapped at him. "Earth shoes are very good for your feet. All the best magazines say so. And I happen to be a size 7 for your information. That's practically petite."
"So what have your feet got to do with anything? It's late, honey."
He began to push his bike again, and she fell in beside him.
"Nothing, I guess. It's just that Harold kept looking at my feet. After the meeting when we were sitting out on the grass and talking things over."
She shook her head, frowning a little.
"Now, why would Harold Lauder be interested in my feet?" she asked.
When Larry and Lucy got home, they were by themselves, walking hand in hand. Sometime before, Leo had gone into the house where he stayed with Nadine Mom. Now, as they walked toward the door, Lucy said,
"It was quite a meeting.
I never thought—"
Her words caught in her throat as a dark form unfolded itself from the shadows of their porch. Larry felt hot fear leap up in his throat.
"It's him," he thought wildly. "He's come to get me. I'm going to see his face."
But then he wondered how he could have thought that, because it was Nadine Cross, that was all. She was wearing a dress of some soft bluish-gray material, and her hair was loose, flowing over her shoulders and down her back, dark hair shot with skeins of purest white.
"She sort of makes Lucy look like a used car on a scalper's lot," he thought before he could help himself, and then hated himself for thinking it. That was the old Larry talking.
Oh, old Larry, you might as well say old Adam.
"Nadine," Lucy was saying shakily, with one hand pressed to her chest, "you gave me the fright of my life. I thought, well, I don't know what I thought."
She took no notice of Lucy.
"Can I talk to you?" she asked Larry.
"What, now?"
He looked sideways at Lucy, or thought he did. Later he was never able to remember what Lucy had looked like in that moment. It was as if she had been eclipsed, but by a dark star rather than by a bright one.
"Now. It has to be now."
"In the morning would—"
"It has to be now, Larry, or never."
He looked at Lucy again, and this time he did see her, saw the resignation on her face as she looked from Larry to Nadine and back again. He saw the hurt.
"I'll be right in, Lucy."
"No, you won't," she said dully.
Tears had begun to sparkle in her eyes.
"Oh, no, I doubt it."
10 minutes.
10 minutes, 10 years, Lucy said.
"She's come to get you. Did you bring your dog collar and your muzzle, Nadine?"
For Nadine, Lucy Swan did not exist. Her eyes were fixed only on Larry, those dark, wide eyes. For Larry, they would always be the strangest, most beautiful eyes he had ever seen. The eyes that come back to you, calm and deep, when you're hurt or in bad trouble or maybe just about out of your mind with grief.
"I'll be in, Lucy," he said automatically.
"Sheik, go on."
"Yes, I guess I will. She's come. I'm dismissed."
She ran up the steps, stumbling on the top one, regaining her balance, pulling the door open, closing it behind her with a slam, cutting off the sound of her sobs even as they started. Nadine and Larry looked at each other for a long time as if entranced. "This is how it happens," he thought. "When you catch someone's eyes across a room and never forget them, or see someone at the far end of a crowded subway platform that could have been your double, or hear a laugh on the street that could have been the laugh of the first girl you ever made love to." But something in his mouth tasted so bitter.
"Let's walk down to the corner and back," Nadine said in a low voice. "Would you do that much?"
"I better go into her. You picked one hell of a bad time to come here."
"Please, just down to the corner and back. If you want, I'll get down on my knees and beg. If that's what you want, here, see?"
And to his horror, she did get down on her knees, pulling her skirt up a little so she could do it, showing him her bare legs, making him curiously certain that everything else was bare as well. Why should he think that? He didn't know. Her eyes were on him, making his head spin. And there was a sickening feeling of power involved here someplace, involved with having her on her knees before him, her mouth on a level with—
"Get up," he said roughly.
He took her hands and yanked her to her feet, trying not to see the way the skirt rode up even more before falling back into place. Her thighs were the color of cream, that shade of white that is not pale and dead, but vigorous and healthy and enticing.
"Come on," he said, almost totally unnerved.
They walked west, in the direction of the mountains, which were a negative presence far ahead, triangular patches of darkness blotting out the stars that had come out after the rain. Walking toward those mountains at night always made him feel queerly uneasy, but somehow adventurous. And now, with Nadine by his side, her hand resting lightly in the crook of his elbow, those feelings seemed heightened. He had always had vivid dreams, and 3 or 4 nights ago, about those mountains. He had dreamed there were trolls in them, hideous creatures with bright green eyes, the oversized heads of hydrocephalic cretins, and short-fingered, powerful hands.
Strangler's hands. Idiot trolls, guarding the passes through the mountains, waiting until his time came around. The time of the Dark Man. A soft breeze meandered down the street, blowing papers before it. They passed King Supers, a few shopping carts standing in the big parking lot like dead sentinels, making him think of the Lincoln Tunnel. There had been trolls in the Lincoln Tunnel. They had been dead, but that didn't mean all the trolls in their new world were dead.
"It's hard," Nadine said, her voice still low. "She made it hard because she's right. I want you now, and I'm afraid I'm too late. I want to stay here."
"Nadine, no," she said fiercely. "Let me finish." "I want to stay here. Can't you understand that? And if we're with each other, I'll be able to." "You're my last chance," she said, her voice breaking. "Joe's gone now."
"No, he hasn't," Larry said, feeling slow and stupid and bewildered.
"We dropped him off at your place on the way home. Isn't he there?"
"No. There's a boy named Leo Rockway asleep in his bed."
"What are you—" "Listen," she said. "Listen to me. Can't you listen? As long as I had Joe, I was all right. I could be as strong as I had to be. But he doesn't need me anymore. And I need to be needed."
"He does need you."
"Of course he does," Nadine said.
And Larry felt afraid again. She wasn't talking about Leo anymore. He didn't know who she was talking about.
"He needs me. That's what I'm afraid of. That's why I came to you."
She stepped in front of him and looked up, her chin tilted. He could smell her secret, clean scent, and he wanted her. But part of him turned back toward Lucy. That was the part of him he needed if he was going to make it here in Boulder. If he let it go and went with Nadine, they might as well slink out of Boulder tonight. It would be finished with him. The old Larry triumphant.
"I have to go home," he said. "I'm sorry. You'll have to work it out on your own, Nadine."
"Work it out on your own." Weren't they the words he had been using to people in one form or another all his life? Why did they have to rise up this way when he knew he was right, and still catch him, and twist in him, and make him doubt himself?
"Make love to me," she said, and put her arms around his neck.
She pressed her body against his, and he knew by its looseness, its warmth and springiness, that he had been right. She was wearing the dress, and that was all. Buck naked underneath, he thought, and thinking it excited him blackly.
"That's all right. I can feel you," she said, and began to wriggle against him, sideways, up and down, creating a delicious friction. "Make love to me, and that will be the end of it. I'll be safe. Safe. I'll be safe."
He reached up, and later he never knew how he was able to do that when he could have been inside her warmth and only three quick movements and one thrust, the way she wanted it. But somehow he reached up and unlocked her hands and pushed her away with such force that she stumbled and almost fell. A low moan came from her.
"Larry, if you knew—"
"Well, I don't. Why don't you try telling me instead of raping me?"
"Rape?" she repeated, laughing shrilly. "Oh, that's funny. Oh, what you said. Me rape you. Oh, Larry."
"Whatever you want from me, you could have had. You could have had it last week or the week before. The week before that I asked you to take it. I wanted you to have it."
"That was too soon," she whispered.
"And now it's too late," he said, hating the brutal sound of his voice but unable to control it. He was still shaking all over from wanting her. How was he supposed to sound? "What are you going to do, huh?"
"All right. Goodbye, Larry."
She was turning away. In that instant, she was more than Nadine, turning her back on him forever. She was the oral hygienist. She was Yvonne, with whom he had shared an apartment in L.A. She had pissed him off, and so he had just slipped into his boogie shoes, leaving her holding the lease. She was Rita Blakemore. Worst of all, she was his mother. "Nadine?" She didn't turn around. She was a black shape, distinguishable from other black shapes only when she crossed the street. Then she disappeared altogether against the black background of the mountains.
He called her name once again, and she didn't answer. There was something terrifying in the way she had left him, the way she had just melted into that black backdrop. He stood in front of King Supers, hands clenched, brow covered with pearls of sweat in